Thanks for coming, and above all, thanks for inviting me over. It's really nice out here. My name is Kai Noske. I currently work at the CFA. I have been a LIGT observatory before, and that's where most of this work was actually done, together with a larger scale survey I'm involved in. I'm gonna talk about this in a second. I'd like to talk about star formation in Field Galaxies since a redshift of about one, and how we found a rather quiescent but very mass-dependent history of star formation in galaxies probably similar to our Milky Way. Now, why bother at all? There have been a couple of observational results.
There's a pointer right underneath the screen if you want.
Do you mean an actual mechanical pointer?
Yes, a mechanical pointer.
Ah, I see. Great. Nice. It's even like mesh. Right. So there are a couple of observational results on what has been happening roughly during about the last two-thirds of the age of the universe. Now, as all of you know, if you look at the evolution of the co-moving star formation rate density of the universe, since a redshift of about one, you've had a decline of roughly a factor of 10. So star formation in general went down in galaxies. One proposed origin of that evolution was for quite a while that the merger rate, major galaxy mergers, but also minor galaxy mergers, would increase with redshift, and that the high star formation rates you would observe in galaxies at redshift of one and above would largely be merger-driven. From the things we have been finding for about the last 2 years from galaxy morphologies, whether they're mergers or not, and from the things I'm going to present today, we know this is probably not the case. Second, not only has star formation declined since the redshift of one, but this also depended on the galaxy mass. There has been a lot of downsizing being pushed around in the community, and what people mean is that massive galaxies form the bulk of their stellar mass early, whereas less massive galaxies experience their star formation with a lower efficiency on lower levels, but over longer timescales. That's why less massive galaxies today still form stars. Now, how is it that we understand star formation in galaxy-wide scales? And currently, unfortunately, not too well if we go outside the local universe. Now, of course, I could give you the motivational speech and how we need to understand this, how this is one of probably one of the holy grails, because once we understand star formation on a galaxy-wide scale, it means we understand what the baryons do, we understand all the small-scale physics. And, well, you know all of that. We need that to understand the evolution of light and chemistry in galaxies and the universe. We need that to understand how precisely dark matter is illuminated, how we have to transform our galaxy counts and galaxy clustering into the evolution of clustering of dark matter to infer cosmology and so on. Now, on the theoretical side, of course, we don't have a complete understanding on small scales. That's why you are here. On larger scales, we don't fully understand what the gas dynamics are. Of course, there are pretty good prescription of cooling and accretion. People work on feedback and winds, but so far there is, of course, no general agreement. Partly this is due to general limits of resolution in the simulations. You're just usually in a cosmological simulation, you're getting the order of 100, maybe several, 10, per, no, it's usually of the order of the hundreds of parsecs in an n-body simulations. So you can either assume that you know what the initial conditions for a galaxy already in place are, and you make a guess, and then you have a galaxy evolve from basically generating out of nowhere and having a high-resolution simulation, or you run a cosmological simulation with limited resolution and then pick out your galaxies and re-simulate the thing, hoping that actually when making the transition from a low to the localized high resolution, you make no mistake. And there's a couple of issues with that. So currently there's technical limitations too on getting the baryon dynamics on a large scale right. So what people are currently doing, and this is true both for semi-analytic models where you don't actually trace the gas but just plug in a general prescription on top of the dark matter, or also in a hydrocode, you still have a semi-empirical treatment of star formation. which of course some assumptions on the efficiency, timescales, feedback, and so on, that you can probably calibrate reasonably well at redshift 0, but have so far not been able to trace well at redshift greater than 1. Because on the observational side, although there has been rapid progress, there still was no comprehensive picture at a redshift significantly larger than 0. So we had only a limited idea on whether starburst would be the dominant mode of star formation to observe, what the mass dependencies were, and so on. There was just a reasonable test bed missing. So currently people are releasing the data from the new multi-wavelength servers that are pretty deep, and I've been working on one. It's Aegis, the All Wavelength Extended Gross Trip International Survey, and this is just a flashy slide. Oops. Sorry about that. Flashy slide. It's basically up in the Big Dipper, a long strip where we have KAG spectroscopy, HST imaging, deep Spitzer infrared data, galaxy UV data, deep Chandra X-ray. Of course, you have all these things in the Goods fields too, a little bit deeper. On the other hand, these fields are usually a little bit smaller. But what's currently happening is that all these fields kind of grow together into something that's probably best described as the greater Goods, both by the personal overlap and also by the data sets. Most of the current deep surveys focus on a couple of preferred fields. And suddenly, we have a very nice set of multi-wavelength data that we can explore and can get a more complete picture on star formation, AGN activity, and whatever we're interested in galaxy evolution back in time. Yeah, we are using our data, but ignore that. It's just the advertising slide. So, I'm going to stay with this plot for a while, and this has almost all the results that I'm going to show. So here we have our data in four redshift bins, roughly 0.3, 0.5, 0.8, and roughly 1. On the x-axis, you've got log of stellar mass, high masses on the right, low masses on the left, and you got log of the star formation rate on the y-axis. You see there is these blue dots, which are, as I'll show in a second, are the star-forming galaxies. We have some stuff scattered below, and I'm going to cut out one of these panels and zoom in and show you what we found here. So here we are at redshift roughly 0.8, stellar mass and star formation rate. Now you see there's kind of a slightly bimodal distribution of stuff. Here's this relation between star formation rate and stellar mass that these points seem to display. And as we looked at their properties and their morphologies, dominated by disk morphologies, they're usually 24 micron detected, so they have a decent amount of mid-infrared emission. They're usually blue, and they usually have emission lines with properties that point to these galaxies being star-forming. So it looks like we have fiducial star-forming galaxies here on this blue color-coded sequence. These make roughly two-thirds of the sample at these redshifts.
If you look at the slope, is the star formation rate per unit mass constant?
This is star formation rate, not per unit mass. It's just.
I know, but it has a slope, so I'm wondering.
No, it's not quite constant. Okay. There's different authors find different slopes, and I find that this, from just a few experiments, you find the slope kind of depends on what star formation rate traces you use. So I'll come back to this in a moment. And actually, the star formation rate per unit mass seems to increase, or is consistently found to increase to lower masses. And we have a slightly offbeat interpretation for that. I'm going to come to this in a bit.
Are you going to discuss how you calibrated the star formation rate very briefly?
Yes, sure, can do that. So the filled dots, these filled blue dots, you probably have a hard time seeing it from afar, have star formation rates that come from combining mid-infrared emission. So we look at the 24 micron filter from Spitzer Space Telescope data, and we extrapolate basically by selecting on a luminosity criterion, selecting a suitable template and infer a total IR luminosity. This means.
Luminosity-dependent
yes.
Template.
Yeah.
Which templates do you use?
Charin Albaz. You could also use Dale and Helu, and I check them against each other and they make virtually no difference. Yeah.
Yeah, it depends on the alpha that you use for the Dale and Lou models, but you know, there's a detail. Thanks. And this is infrared only, or it's UV plus?
It's UV plus infrared. So the idea is, basically, the spectral energy distribution of a galaxy is kind of like a wedge. Infrared, UV. Depending, for a star forming galaxy, you would have a lot of UV, obviously, unless you crank up the extinction, and the extinction is correlated with total star formation rate. So with time, if you crank up star formation, what usually happens, your extinction goes up. You have a lot of IR emission, which is usually just thermal dust, because the UV continuum photons heat the dust, get absorbed. UV goes down. So what we usually have for massive galaxies, they pump out most of the bolometric luminosity in the infrared. For these guys down here, the open circles, for these we use emission lines to infer star formation rates. If they're not IR detected, you have to infer most of the star formation rate from the ultraviolet. So the best current guess that we have for the total star formation rate is adding the infrared inferred and the UV inferred star formation rates, hoping that basically we are getting the stuff that's extincted and the stuff that's not extincted. It's just leaking out. So here for these galaxies, we just get upper limits, and these are very conservative upper limits. So these down arrows, these are, if you look at the morphologies, red sequence galaxies, elliptical galaxies with virtually no detected star formation. And then we got these oddballs down here. Look kind of scattered. They're not infrared detected, but we find emission lines, weak emission lines. Usually they're also red early type galaxies. And if you look at the emission line ratios where we have the right emission lines, they have characteristics of Linus or AGN, at least two-thirds of them. So they're not really star-forming galaxies, or at most a few of them. And the star formation rates that I plot here are overestimated. So if you look at the whole picture, you have star-forming galaxies forming a defined relation between star formation rate and stellar mass, and non-star-forming galaxies that here look kind of too closely connected. In fact, they will be way down here. So that's a flashy term. I'm going to talk about what we call the main sequence of star-forming galaxies. It started off by just sloppily using it without thinking. And Sandy Faber actually told me you should stay with that term. And after we thought for a little bit, I think it makes sense, unless, of course, one is afraid of causing confusion with stellar evolution. Because here we have a defined relation between a galaxy's mass and its star formation history, which is most of its evolutionary path, which is, I think, as close as it gets to looking at the mass-dependent evolution of stars in the Hertzsprung-Russell diagram. And we think that this understanding the sequence and how it comes into being actually encodes most of what we need to know about normal star formation prior to any violent shutdown, mergers, and so on in galaxies. Now, we have what I'm showing here are the means of log star formation as a function of mass for our fiducial star-forming galaxies, and the plus minus one sigma limits. And what we find is that out to a redshift of one, a little bit above probably, the majority of star-forming galaxies form a defined sequence with a limited range of star formation at a given stellar mass and redshift. And the upper limit of the range of star formation at a given mass and redshift is about plus minus 0.3 dex. Of course, what we think, because if you bin these data a bit different.
You mean the upper limit is that red line?
These are equivalent for a Gaussian distribution. This would be the plus minus one sigma limits.
I see.
About these median points.
Upper, what is it? There's plus or minus 0.3 dex. Because it seems to me there's a lot of scatter in those.
Sorry? Yeah.
A lot of scatter.
Yeah, this is one sigma. If you actually the distribution, if you cut at a given mass and redshift, this distribution looks roughly log normal.
Okay.
So this would be roughly, yeah. So actually, it really includes plus minus 34% of the galaxies. So for a normal distribution, this would be the one sigma limit.
And the dotted line, the vertical dotted line, is where you're.
Oh, sorry. The vertical dotted line is. I should have told that. This is the limit to where we are complete in stellar mass. The stellar mass limit to where we are complete for all the galaxies. So below this limit, you would be losing red galaxies, mostly. You're relatively complete. You're 80% complete in the whole range where I plot the data. So this means you get almost all of the star-forming galaxies because your losses are the right galaxies. This is because of our galaxy selection in the observed R band, which is a rest frame blue band at redshifts of 1-ish, and also because obviously we get our redshifts from the surveys mostly from emission lines, and red galaxies usually just don't have them, or only very weak ones. Now, there have been a couple of different papers that found a very similar thing. Now, at redshift zero, this thing, this defined relation between star formation and stellar mass was already known since about 2004 from Jarl Brinkmann's paper using the Sloan survey. So locally, people knew there was such a defined relation. At redshifts greater than zero, until recently, not. So a little bit after we published our papers, David Abbas used the even deeper Goetz infrared data to derive this relation at a redshift of one. And in fact, there's a smaller total sample because the Goetz area is smaller, the infrared data are better. And this proved that, in fact, also at a redshift of one, you have a defined relation between star formation rate and stellar mass. The scaling of the plot is different than the ones I just showed. And a bimodality for this red, usually, as we think, AGN linear galaxies, and the ordinary star-forming galaxies. And also at a redshift of one, the range of star formation at a given mass and redshift is very similar to what we find at lower redshift.
But isn't it deeper than the relation?
No, it's just wider.
No, I mean, it's two orders of magnitude in both ranges. In your case, was more like one order of magnitude in the vertical range versus two in the horizontal.
The mass range is bigger here because the Goetz data are deeper. So I was actually cutting here. And in fact, they get a somewhat steeper slope.
Yeah, it is steeper, right, than yours?
Yeah, mine is of the order of the log star formation versus log stellar mass of the order 0.7. They get of the order of 0.9. Yeah. I think part of it may be due to the fact that these are only blue galaxies, whereas I also include red galaxies that I think are star forming. That would be down here. That could be part of the effect. But also maybe different prescriptions of star formation rate tracers, because at this moment the slope is roughly constrained but not really precisely constrained. There's other work using Galax data in Cosmos out of redshift to 0.7 by Michel Zamoyski. I found a very similar thing. Relatively independent of what star formation rate tracers, what stellar mass tracers use, out to a redshift of 1-ish or so, the surveys are deep enough and give consistently the view that star-forming galaxies stay together at a given mass with respect to their star-formation history. Now, what can we infer from the fact that there is a limited range in star formation? Now, of course, you could easily use this 1 sigma plus minus 0.3 dex in star formation rate argument and say that statistically galaxies at 2/3 of their time within a factor of 2 of their average star formation rate at that redshift. This is a constraint on episodic star formation on starbursts.
They can move to the red clump and back.
In principle, but then they would have to change the morphology in most of them would. I know we'd probably not all on the same boat on this one. But if you believe that star-forming galaxies will stay star-forming and have a relatively and do not have a strong amplitude between these mostly elliptical galaxies, mostly early types and reds.
That's true, but in your analysis, it doesn't take into account any of the morphologies, right? So it's just based on. I mean, your argument is correct if you assume that the galaxies stay within that sequence.
Yes, right? This is right. Yeah.
I think there's
this is actually a strong assumption, I admit that. But
I mean, it's a critical assumption. And so the constraint would be weaker if galaxies could move to the red clump and back. And of course, you know, there are limits on that as well, because we know from the morphologies that and the sizes that probably most of them are on the red sequence a long time. So, I mean, that's an extra constraint. But there's still plenty of room for that.
I guess it depends on the time average too, because they normally also cluster quite differently. Yeah. It's not that you can take a blue one and
true.
Split it into the
but,
red one.
But you know, all these extra derivative results, including the clustering and the morphologies, they are in even more uncertain than this first order analysis. I mean, this is pretty robust, you know, give or take the assumption that they're on the sequence.
Yes, I mean, I've had this discussion a couple of times, and I agree with you. If you allow for, so these are 80-something percent disk galaxies. These are the red ones, basically these guys that have no emission whatsoever, the red and dead galaxies, or what I think will probably remain red and dead galaxies. They are almost all, with a few exceptions, are early types.
Yeah, but I agree. But the thing to keep in mind is that apparently a spiral galaxy can move into can turn into an S0, which is indistinguishable.
But just dimming down the disk, you're saying?
In a few hundred megahertz, 500 megahertz. Yeah. If it kills star formation, its morphology will change drastically, and you wouldn't recognize it as a spiral anymore, but you would recognize it
that's
as
right,
a
yeah.
Especially a redshift 0.7 or so, where you need to have exquisite data to even get the morphologies.
And yeah, so I know that they just
caution that there's. I mean, you're right that it's not a completely unreasonable assumption that they're on the blue sequence.
And I would agree that at least for a subpopulation, it's say a zeros, for instance. I think it would probably be possible. Then again, this thing is relatively independent of morphology, surprisingly. So if I cut the sample by quantitative morphologies using Jan Loss's Genie M20 or some other quantitative code, it looks like whether I use IM peculiars or at least late type spirals rather than early type spirals, they lie on this thing too, on this relation. So you could, if you wanted to exclude galaxies that might morphologically be allowed to transition between the weakly star forming or the off mode and the on mode, and you would still get this result. But then, of course, you would have to be proof against your argument. You would have to narrow it down to probably the low bulge or highly irregular systems. Well, say SC and later. Then we'll probably prove against that.
So speaking of that, are you going to talk about at some point where the Milky Way lies on that?
The Milky Way lies, depending on what IMF, this is a Krupa IMF, the Milky Way lies about here. And at redshift zero, it has about 3 solar masses a year. We don't have redshift zero out here. So the Milky Way is about
what
here.
What worries me is that if you're going to say that, then the star formation rate increases substantially as you go back in time. But there's no evidence for that, right?
I know. And the Milky Way, there's... but in all the other disk galaxies back in time, you see that. So either the Milky Way is a real oddball...
Well, I thought that generally that later type spirals, the way the Milky Way is, have been having... their star formation rate has not been declining that much, whereas the earlier type, like M31, is thought to be somewhat earlier type. So it does, it's definitely, this average star formation rate is much higher than the current one.
Yes, and...
About other SCD galaxies, generally that's not true, but you probably know more about that.
Only statistically, basically. So I wouldn't know about every galaxy in the local environment where you can do a detailed analysis of their star formation history. So, but the Milky Way nowadays is a little bit below where it should be in star formation rate.
I'm more worried about it going in the past, because in the past it was about the same as it is now, so then it's getting farther and farther out of whack.
Yeah. For today's not so massive galaxies, the time scales are longer. I'm going to get to that in a bit. Yeah.
But for the Milky Way, is the constraint primarily in Sun Hippodrome, or is actually global over the entire galaxy?
Well, it's within a few kiloparsecs.
Maybe because currently maybe we're missing most of the information for the inner part of the galaxy in this argument.
That's right. Well,
that would be the dominant star formation rate in the past, and this is a global star formation.
Well, of course, no. This leaves out the bulge, but in terms of the disk, there's an exponential disk. Molecular gas, there's an exponential disk of stars, and they both have roughly the same slope. Anyway.
No, I was listening.
Yeah.
Okay. So again, if you believe that galaxies stay in the sequence and don't transition on short timescales, then this puts a strong constraint on what major and minor mergers do to galaxies. Now, modeling these mergers is, at least the effect on star formation, is kind of a problem. Here's a figure from T.J. Cox et al. 2006. And this is the evolution of star formation. So this is the first passage, final coalescence, for a low feedback. So there's little self-regulation in the star formation. And for the assumption of high feedback. As you can see, the general course is really quite different. There's the amplitude of star formation variations is a factor of several. For a low feedback assumption, you have a brief and really intense burst of star formation. In a high feedback case, the whole thing happens on a way lower level. It has a way lower effect on the star formation history of the galaxy. It doesn't cause such intense a starburst. If you had a longer time scale, if I remember right, everything was more stretched out in time.
But isn't the resulting accretion onto the central black hole going to be different also? So that in the
This is only star formation, but I would.
Oh, well, when they put in the feedback, I thought that meant they blew out gas faster. And so
I think it would be surprising if it wasn't, right? Because, yeah.
So only one of them might fit the, last dispersion, black hole mass dispersion, and stable dispersion. I don't know.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I think in these simulations, TJ didn't have black hole growth in there. I might be wrong about this, but.
Mm-hmm.
The total number of galaxies in the blue sequence again. The total number of points you have in your data set.
With these mass cuts, I believe 3,000-ish. In the blue sequence, probably like 2,000 or so. It's pretty deceptive since they overlap a little bit. So anyway, you can statistically constrain the effect of mergers by adopting a merger rate, putting different star formation templates on top of the mergers in cosmological simulations, and inferring the expected distribution of star formation rates. Now, the second thing that actually was probably the most surprising was that if you look at this range of star formation plus minus 0.3 dex, it didn't really seem to change from redshift of almost zero, and if you look at the redshift zero data from Sloan that I just showed you, to a redshift of one or so. And this is true for all the different studies that have done this. So the range in log star formation rate at a given mass and redshift remains roughly the same. It doesn't quite look like that here, but you have just more points over here. You should really look at the plus minus one sigma limits.
I understand. It rose substantially. On the left is all less than 10, and on the right it's almost all greater than 10.
No, the range around
the
about
width.
Yeah. What's happening is that the normalization of the sequence grows with time. And from redshift 0 to 1, it grows by about a factor of 6. The slope might also change, but this is still dodgy because we still have to work with the uncertain star formation retracer and limited sample and mass ranges and so on. But it is enough to say yet that the dominant mode of star formation evolution since redshift about 1 is apparently a gradual decrease in star formation rate in individual galaxies, not an evolving role of starbursts. So the frequency of, or amplitude of starbursts does not seem to relatively evolve significantly from redshift 0 to 1, but the general level of star formation in galaxies. At a given mass, a galaxy just had about between six and ten times higher star formation rate at a redshift of 1. A secondary effect, if you think about the Madamadao plot, is that some massive galaxies underwent some quenching where star formation was shut down. So the general decline, the smooth decline of star formation in galaxies, and the shutdown of star formation in some massive galaxies go apparently hand in hand to create what we see in the Madamadao plot.
As a note, the width that you find, the 0.3 dex, that's actually the same as what we found out in redshift from redshift 1 to 3. In the recent paper that we discussed, right, we thought there might be a discrepancy, but the scatter, so this very small scatter for the blue star forming galaxies, seems to persist out in redshift 3. We find 0.35 dex guy around the region.
I found 0.35 too.
Yeah.
But then I used a lower limit on the uncertainty, a lower limit on random scatter and star formation rate, and took that out.
So but that's remarkable that even at higher altitude, this sequence of star forming galaxies seems to be very narrow.
Also, if you look at Naveen Reddy and Don Erb's papers from H alpha and infrared for Lyman Break galaxies, and Emanuele Dadi's paper, who also combines IR and UV at redshift of 2, they all find pretty much the same observed scatter. And it remains remarkably stable from redshift of above 2 to 1 to 0.
So why is this a surprise? I would have thought we know how many starbursts there are, so why wouldn't people already have known that they don't?
We don't.
That's all the point. No, we know how many there are locally.
Well, yeah, but the universe is very different than hydrogen.
I thought even at hybrids, well, I don't know how far out it should go, but I thought...
Yeah, I think maybe for theorists, it's not so surprising, because you always adopted, well, a disk evolution, and you would assume that you have a relatively well-behaved star formation history in there. On the observer side, people found all these luminous infrared galaxies with infrared luminosities above 10 to the 11 solar luminosities. So this is the green line, actually. This is the luminous infrared galaxy luminosity limit. So at a redshift of 0, these are pretty rare, and they're almost always disturbed galaxies. So for galaxies with an enormously high star formation rate in the local universe, people thought you needed a merger event, at least some strong interaction. This was kind of transferred to high redshifts. The observing a star formation rate of several 10 solar masses a year was still oftentimes described as a starburst. Now, if you understand a starburst not just an episode or an extended episode of strong star formation, but a brief peak of star formation due to some event, that's probably not right. It looks like almost all star-forming galaxies, as long as they're massive enough, are lurks at high redshift. And they look like relatively undisturbed spiral galaxies, most of them, if you look at them morphologically. So the early suggestion, mostly from infrared observers, that strongly star-forming galaxies at high redshift are major merger-driven, brief starbursts, brief dusty starbursts, therefore infrared luminous, is probably not right. It's probably once a galaxy is forming stars, it's forming stars at a high rate, at high redshift. Probably because they're just more gas rich, and if you go down in time, gas reservoirs or gas accretion rates are going down.
So is it known, because you can measure molecular gas out to large redshift, so is it known whether they are more gas rich or not?
You know, I wouldn't know.
They can't do H1 yet, but they can.
No, you can't.
CO is not even, it's only for the beasts.
I'm sorry,
the general sample that he has here is barely observable.
I would think that you mostly can see it in submillimeter galaxies, which are really...
You would see the, but then again, only the beasts. Submillimeter galaxies are richer than high, one and higher. Yeah, it's 5 months old in the last 3 years. Or blazing AGNs, and they often go by.
Right, 5 years ago, but even maybe we can go to as low as redshift, and then it'd be, well, I guess then I have to go to a second one before I start getting a significant number of blinks.
So we don't have H1 there.
Well, I know you don't have any, can't do H1 yet, but I'm just wondering whether you can do, whether people have tried to get the molecular mass.
But you have spectra, right?
Yes, we do.
And you also have both infrared and UV, so you get a clue from the amount of dust if there should be more mass or more gas or not.
There's a recent
recent
paper from the Galax team led by Christopher Martin, who actually made that assumption, and they're actually getting a result consistent with that. They're just looking at the amount of extinction, and they allow extinction to scale with the amount of ISM that you have. And they find an evolution consistent with this way.
Have you ever plotted the average star formation rate it would have needed prior to this epoch to get to its stellar mass? Because just doing this in my head, it looks exactly like the median values that you find are exactly the amount of star formation that was required from high redshift to go to whatever redshift bin you have to get the stellar mass you see. Right, so
I didn't get that.
At redshift, so at redshift 1, you know, you had a good 3-4 billion years
right.
or something to form the 10 to the 11, say, solar mass galaxy.
Yeah.
So if you say, okay, 5 giga years, I need about star formation rate of 20 solar masses a year to get 10 to the 11.
I did this to some extent in a couple of transparencies from now by looking at doubling times.
Yeah, it's very simple. It's your integral of star formation rate in your plot the same as your mass function.
Because it's interesting, there's quite a bit of leverage in cosmic time that you have.
This is what people, the games that people have been playing with integrating with the dot plot,
yeah.
and then seeing whether you get the buildup of star mass. But you can do that within a sample, right? And then see it as it happens. And that's something that you, in principle, could probably do with your data.
Yeah, I could do that. People have done it the other way around, and I've been just using tau models to keep track of the growth of stellar mass and star formation rate.
Yeah, but the difference would be that other people would use different fields, different methods, and then publish two different results, you know, star formation rates as a function of cosmic time, stellar mass as a function of time, from completely different data. But you can use the same data, the same galaxies, so you have a much better constraint.
In principle, that's true, yeah.
That's
but
right,
I haven't.
Because, you know, you can actually figure out, did the galaxy have to have a star formation rate much higher than the one that you observed to get to its stellar mass? Did it have a lower one in the past? Or did it have that same average star formation rate, even in those 5, 8, 10 billion years before you observed
it? Yeah, and it gets more and more interesting the further you get back in time, because you're getting closer and closer to the beginning. And this actually gives you a constraint when galaxies started forming their stars, or what the history was prior to redshift of 1. Is that what you're basically going for? Yeah.
Wait a second. You don't know which one is the precursor to which, so you don't know how much each galaxy individually has moved in mass.
I know how much mass it has now, and it might have been lots of different pieces.
Yes.
But I know what the star formation rate integrated over all these pieces had to be to get 10 to the 11 solar masses. Because I know the time, and I know the amount of stars. And so the star formation rate is just the mass you have divided by the time you were forming stars. So that the average star formation rate it had prior to you observing.
I understand what you say, but suppose that the galaxy, these are different galaxies in each of these four plots, right? Mm-hmm. So there is no guarantee that it's equivalent to looking at the same galaxies in the past, right? I mean, you're hoping they're making the assumption. We're making the assumption that each sample is a fair sample of the entire galaxy population.
Yeah, that's basically the assumption. The assumption is that the volume is so large that this is that at each time interval, at each cosmological slice,
it's a complete fair sample.
You have a complete fair sample. This is not entirely true, but this you can estimate from simulations from cold dark matter. Just, you know, to see the differences in densities and stuff.
Yeah.
So that's fairly well understood, at least the order of magnitude there that you have.
Actually, I played this game at least statistically as a function of galaxy mass for a redshift of a bit less than one sample. And this is when I'm now going to talk a little bit about the mass dependencies. We know that galaxies decreased in star formation rate, the star-forming ones, but they didn't do so all the same way. And here's a slide that I use for public talks up in Lick Observatory. You got massive galaxies over here, small galaxies down here. And small galaxies remain kind of bluish over time, remain kind of smallish, whereas massive galaxies just turn red. Well, big deal, you know all of that. This is likely because these had rapid starburst and gas consumption, and these did it in a slow way. So what was happening there back in time? But anyway, you can do it a little bit more detailed. So Now let's cut out the star forming galaxies ratio 0.75 to 1. This is the doubling time. So given the current star formation rate of the galaxy, how many years will it take to make the same stellar mass again? Or how many years would it have taken the galaxy to make the current stellar mass? You see a strong dependence on stellar mass. We are actually complete, 80% complete, means we're getting most of the star-forming galaxies down to 10 to the 10 solar masses. So we are allowed to actually look at these galaxies down here. Now, for these guys, we're getting a few giga-years. Say it's about 2 to 3 giga-years out here on average to double the stellar mass. In the redshift range we are now, this means they would have a higher than past average star formation rate if they were old. Say, if all galaxies formed at a redshift of 5 or so, then these galaxies are already older than their doubling time, which means their current star formation rate is higher than their past average star formation rate. So again, if you assume that all galaxies started forming stars at redshift 5, could be anything from 3 to, say, 10 or so, you could just assume all galaxies started coevally forming star formation at high redshift. Then they are all old. And then a lot of galaxies have a doubling time shorter than their age, which means they would be in a starburst mode. Did everybody get that, or should I? Okay. We can look at the current star formation rate of the galaxy. And we can ask, at the current star formation rate, how long would it have taken the galaxy to make all its stellar mass? We find there's a dependence on galaxy mass. For massive galaxies, it would be larger than the age of the universe at a redshift of 1. Redshift of 1, the universe is roughly 6 billion years old. Massive galaxies, on average, have a doubling time of like 10 giga-years. So this means already at a redshift of 1, their star formation rate is lower than their past average star formation rate. If you go to less massive galaxies, they form stars so rapidly that they would make all of their stellar mass in, say, 2 giga-years. So if you assume that they started forming stars at the beginning of the universe, then their current star formation is higher than their past average. Now the problem that you run into with that is that if you think that all of the low-mass galaxies are as old as the high-mass galaxies, then their doubling times tell you that they are all in starburst mode. Because if they had been forming stars at the current rate, at the redshift 1 rate, since a redshift of, say, 5, they would largely overproduce their stellar mass. Can't be. They all now would have to undergo an episode of increased star formation with respect to their past. So, roughly speaking, most of the star-forming low-mass galaxies, 50 to 80%, depending, it's getting worse at lower masses probably, would have to simultaneously be in a starburst, in a late enhancement of their star formation history.
Why?
Because the star formation rates are so high.
Yeah, but your samples are incomplete at 10 to the 10.
Yeah, but you're getting at 10 to the 10 we are fine. It's 80%.
You say they have to be simultaneous bursts, but that's not necessarily true because the ones that are not in the burst mode, you won't see.
Yes, but you're getting roughly 80% and you're losing red galaxies. At 10 to the 10, you're 80% complete.
that's a tricky part, right? Do you agree that the, I mean, I agree that if you say that, well, they have to be simultaneous first, and that's impossible, so therefore it's a decline. That's fair. But the only tricky part is that you have to make sure that you're actually getting all the galaxies.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
But even if you were incomplete, I thought that, so only those galaxies are starbursting, the rest you didn't see. But on your previous graph, you argued that most galaxies are not starbursting. So you still have a contradiction, even if you had only a subset of the galaxies.
Yeah. Also, if these guys, yeah, you see this relation, the increase of specific star formation rate or decrease of doubling time to lower masses all the way down to redshift of zero. So the Sloan data show that too, and they are more complete also over a larger mass range. So this is something, it gets more pronounced at a redshift of one, because obviously if you go further back in time, the effect goes stronger. Because we think that these galaxies are actually younger. You can avoid this problem if they formed at a redshift of 1, or just at the upper end of this redshift bin. You would be fine. Because at the current star formation rate, you basically have no time back to the beginning of the galaxy's star formation history. So you would not produce all the stellar mass, and you would be fine. Basically, the galaxies now would be allowed to have a somewhat lower or comparable star formation rate to the one of their past. So using this, the doubling time, it's actually the inverse of the burst parameter, which is current over past average star formation rate. It's strongly dependent on the adopted age of the galaxy, beginning of star formation history. At a redshift of zero, not so much, because look-back times from redshift of zero to redshift of 3 or 5 is not that much of a difference. But at a redshift of 1, it becomes very, very significant.
So if you had to draw some kind of line at the bottom of the scatter plot that would represent things that you can detect that would be only above the line, where would that line lie?
Things that you can detect to be star forming? You mean?
Well, speaking of that, yeah, there should be a line somewhere below that scatter plot. Oh, I guess it would be something like this, below the scatter plot.
You mean something like over here?
No.
Yeah, it's slightly inclined because it depends.
There will be some kind of selection below which you cannot detect it.
Yeah.
Where would that line be? How far from those
just
points?
Just one line, just your pointer. Okay.
Your pointer is my line, yes.
Yeah, because these are...
If there's very slow star formation, then it's also hard to detect.
If you plotted that line that tell me what you can select and what you cannot select at the bottom, where would that be? Exactly where you put the pointer, or where would that be?
We have two selections, stellar mass and star formation rate.
For star formation rate?
This
mass, I mean, it must depend on mass, right?
Yeah, it does somewhat depend on mass, but not very strongly. So what I show here are emission line detected galaxies with a 2-sigma line detection. So this is the sensitivity limit of our emission line star formation rates. The infrared star formation rates, they have their, basically I put in a more conservative limit than was usually assumed, and it cuts off here where the blue dots end.
So if the cutoff is close to where you run out of point, how do you know that you're 80% complete rather than 2%? I mean, how do you know that?
In star formation?
In detecting galaxies as a function of star formation rate.
By looking at
a fixed mass.
At a fixed mass star formation.
You take a bean of mass and you say, I detect this star formation rate. Now we call it doubling time, but it's a star formation rate.
Yeah, definitely.
But you know that below a certain value, you cannot detect anything. And how do you know that you have picked 80% of all the galaxy population rather than 5%?
We know we have picked 80% instead 80% of all the galaxies at that stellar mass. That comes from a stellar mass and selection completeness analysis.
In the previous plot, you had the limits plotted in the...
Yeah.
Could you show that?
Here.
And this is the 0.7 to 1 bit.
Yeah, essentially that's it.
And so this seems to be a little bit higher.
These are 95% completeness limits.
Okay, and the other ones were 80.
Yeah. So at 10 to the 10, you're roughly 80% complete or redshift of 1. Now, not all of these galaxies are star-forming. I only plot those for which we think they are fiducial star-formers. for these are basically all upper limit star formation rates, all the other galaxies. So I'm only talking about the star-forming galaxies here.
So that means the infrared detected ones?
Infrared and emission line detected ones.
Oh, wait, I thought the emission line ones, though, could be AGN.
Weak emission lines down here. These are red galaxies.
I see.
Yeah. So the ones I'm showing here. Come on. These are almost throughout blue. The ones around 10 to the 10, a little bit above.
Okay, actually, how we should let Kai, because we have 10 minutes.
Actually, this was the hardest part of all of this, basically figuring out which galaxies I would call star forming and looking into all the different traces and so on. So, there's actually a lot of technical things to say about this, but where were we? Right. So after all, the only workaround at most redshifts of getting the result that most of the low-mass galaxies, or the majority of low-mass galaxies, get into a starburst mode would allow them to have a delayed onset of their major star formation. Not even all of them. And this is something we came up with to account for that. It's just a very schematic view. We call it staged galaxy formation following and didn't have a good name for it, but Joel Primack suggested one. So the idea here is that, as we know, high-mass galaxies all began their star formation back at some high redshift, all of them, and then had a rapid decline of their star formation, a small decline timescale. Whereas for low-mass galaxies, the range of their onsets of star formation would stretch out to lower and lower redshift. So it would be completely fine to allow a bunch of them, those with longer doubling times, to be as old as the high-mass galaxies. But some of them would need to have a delayed onset of star formation. It would be okay to have a little bit of dribbling beforehand and some progenitors or whatever is going on. But given the current data, unless we are very wrong with all our star formation rate traces, everything points to this delayed onset. There is also some independent studies on that. Here is from the recent paper by Charlie Conroy, Lisa Vexin, and Kraftsov, whom I spelled wrong. Anyway, here they show as a function of redshift zero stellar mass, the mass growth due to star formation since a redshift of 1. And although, of course, the thing is not exactly very sharply constrained, you see that a galaxy with today 10 to the 10 solar masses and stars at a redshift of 1 had only roughly 10% or so of its present-day stellar mass, so formed the vast majority of its stellar mass since a redshift of 1. This is from combining a Hadamard merger tree model and observed stellar mass functions at different redshifts. And then doing something they call abundance matching, where they statistically start assigning the most massive halo, the most massive galaxy, and then marching down in mass. Here is a different study using deep 2 luminosity functions and I think redshift 0 probably Sloan, together with an HOD model, so a clustering analysis. This is from Zheng Zheng, Edith Zihavi, and Alison Coyle. And again, here you have the halo mass at redshift of about 0, and the contribution of mass growth, meaning here stellar mass growth, and for low mass galaxies, low mass halos. So we're not looking at stellar mass here; we're looking at redshift 0 halo mass. So today's low halo mass galaxies had most of their mass growth since a redshift of 1 through star formation. They arrive at 60 or 70%. Also, they stress, so do they, that these are basically more or less proof of concept studies. So the precision here is not really great. And the higher you go up in mass, the more through satellite and central galaxy mergers actually contribute to the mass growth. But it all goes in the same direction. And here's the models that we got for our star-forming galaxies I'm going to show in a second. It all goes in the direction that today's low-mass galaxies on average, had only a relatively small fraction of their stellar mass in place at redshift of 1. Most of it was formed later. But this would support the picture that you would have this somehow declining. So here's redshift of 0, and here's 1, and here's somewhat above. That you had a somewhat declining with some superposed variations, maybe star formation history. And prior to a redshift of 1 or so, or maybe it's coming up a little bit further, you just have something, some dribbling. You don't have a lot of space, a lot of stars left to be formed prior to that. Now, how are we doing? You're almost...
But it's not that strong a constraint, no? Because in some sense, you know, the time above redshift 1 is not that much time, so the drop you're drawing looks like it's a factor of 20.
Yeah, this is exactly. Yeah, it could easily be, if you think that, for instance, you had a relatively low efficiency star formation progenitors or so. If this was more looking,
it's just a factor of 3 less. Yeah.
This is a very very crude, was a very crude schematic and probably an exaggeration of what's going on, but the major star formation statistically was delayed in less massive galaxies. So, yeah. Could be that you have, say, 30% or so formed prior to redshift of 1. So you might have a, depending on when they actually started, you would probably have a factor of several lower star formation rate if we averaged it out. Yeah.
Exactly. So quantitatively, it's just a factor of 3 less.
Yeah, probably. Because it's still hard to say from the data we have now how much of the mass they really had. If they only had like 10%, but yeah, shorter time, I think, yeah, factor of 3 I think is fair. Yeah. Now, of course, we ask the question, how can we understand this gradual decline of star formations in the redshift of world 1? And of course, either gas exhaustion in a very dumb closed box idea, because we know that most of the gas in galaxies was accreted relatively early. So the zeroth order assumption of just using a closed box model with mass-dependent timescales might work. And anyway, even if we cannot really be sure about the physics going on, a parameterization model would be really handy. What we did here was just using tau models, where both the tau and the formation redshift are mass dependent. And what I did was here use power laws of a galaxy's mass, power laws of the total mass. You can tie the tau and the Z formation either to the stellar mass at redshift 0, to some total baryonic mass if you adopt a closed box model. I don't want to explain all of that now because it takes a little bit too long. Or you could also use the halo mass and populate a halo mass model. Also did that. So here you have this time it's the mass normalized specific star formation rate in the 4 redshift bins we've been looking at before. The red line is a model that works going through these median points that are only plot where the sample is complete. And here, these dashed lines adopt an intrinsic variation, intrinsic range of age and time scale at a given galaxy mass. Of course, this is always the same for one and the same model. You see, if you evolve the model with time, not only does it manage to reproduce the average of log star formation rate at a given mass, but also manages to describe the evolution of the range of star formation rate. And I'm working on making it better in the future, but first of all, it needs to be better data and better understood data. Now, of course, you might argue these are tau models, exponential star formation histories. So these are consistent with the gas exhaustion scenario, but they are no proof of that, because you can easily just add another term for star formation driven mass loss and you end up with a with an exponential star formation history again. Also, of course, it's a crude parameterization of a statistical sample evolution. So individual galaxies might quite deviate from that. But what you can do with it, you can use it as an input for all kinds of observational studies and as a first reference model of mass-dependent evolution of star formation rates. Also to test models, and people are currently doing that. So Phil Hopkins recently used this as to generate luminosity function. If you use a simple prescription for dust reddening and this model of a star formation versus stellar mass, you're getting a pretty good prescription of the infrared luminosity function, for example. Of course, I'm also playing with this thing as an input for to derive stellar mass functions, luminosity functions, and so on, by just putting it on top of a halo model, making a very, very crude semi-analytic model, so to say. But I still need to get better constraints on the actual shape on the model parameters. So to quickly wrap up, and this is really only for star-forming field galaxies, not for right and dead ones. I've shown that there's this thing called the main sequence, which has a limited range of star formation at a given mass and redshift, which somewhat limits the effect of mergers and the role of starbursts that don't seem to evolve. Instead, we see the dominant mode of evolution since redshift of 1 seems to be a gradual decline of star formation. Luminous infrared galaxies at redshift of 1 are normal star-forming galaxies in most cases, not extreme starbursts above a much lower population. We are proposing a new picture where the high star formation rates are often not brief starbursts at high redshifts, but early gas-rich phases of a galaxy. I showed these mass-dependent tau models, and the scenario where less massive galaxies have not only longer star formation timescales, but also a systematically later onset of their major star formation, of the first peak, may I call it the initial burst, from which star formation later on declines. Now, I'm going to keep this very short. The nice thing is that this might be a good chance finding a nice relation between galaxy star formation and mass. You have a regular pattern that galaxy star formation history follows, largely dominated by the mass. We still have to figure out what other parameters play a major role. But you can actually quantify it pretty well. You can use it to test models. You can use it as a baseline of what we think is the normal mode of star formation in the absence of violent effects that might quench star formation, such as galaxy mergers, such as the environment. And we're having a student right now working on environmental effects, looking at environmental densities and comparing the star forming sequence in different environments. Of course, we might stand a chance here if we would be superstitious enough or metaphysically enough to think that a smooth relation with mass might signify the same set of few physical processes that are dominant. You could actually identify them, but of course there might be just all kinds of different effects acting at different mass ranges. So this is just about getting better data. You had a really justified criticism about the depth of the data, and right now there's a new infrared survey. It's called FIDEL. It's headed by Mark Dickinson, where they have the goods north and south fields as well as the Aegis field. They will cover this field. They have already covered this field with the Spitzer telescope and the MIPS camera to get very deep 24 and 70 micron data as a hopefully more robust star formation ray tracer. So we will have large samples of galaxies with homogeneous star formation rates out of redshift of 1. Still, there's going to be a lot of homework involved getting AGN and star formation emission disentangled, which is an unsolved problem. Getting good modeling of stellar masses, which is the other axis in this relation. But we hope that in the not too distant future, we might have a better handle with maybe just factors of 2 of systematic uncertainties on the x and the y axis on the redshift of 1 to be able and point to point uncertainties of maybe 40%. to actually get a reasonable handle on the evolution of star formation and its mass dependency, that we can model this way, get timescales as a function of galaxy mass and so on. And therefore, hopefully get a reference star formation history to work with. And a somewhat more sophisticated thing is that we are hoping to populate halo models with such star formation histories and reproduce the total observed distribution so that there would also be some handle on the range of star formation histories and possibly additional quenching that we could infer from the spread of the data once we understand the scatter, the intrinsic scatter of our star formation stellar mass traces well enough to actually model this. Okay. Thank you.